Welcome to the Gila Members Community Radio Show, Earth Matters. Earth Matters brings you in-depth coverage of local, state, and national environmental issues. We want to inform, challenge, engage, and inspire you. Three hosts alternate weekly shows to bring you a broad range of topics and expertise. Your host today is me, Dr. Kim McCrary, Southwest Regional Director and Staff Scientist with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. NM Wild, as we are known by many, is a grassroots organization dedicated to protecting and restoring New Mexico's wild places through advocacy and education and ultimately legislation. Today, we are really fortunate to have Cynthia Wolf on the show to talk about the Wolf Range Rider Program. Cynthia is a range rider in the Mexican Blue Range Recovery Area, Mexican Wolf Blue Range Recovery Area. She's also owner and operator of Wild by Nature, offering wilderness tours in the beautiful Gila. A wildlife biologist with over 20 years of field experience in the West, Cynthia has worked on wolf projects in Idaho and New Mexico. So, welcome to the show, Cynthia.
Thank you.
Well, I'm really excited to have you here today because I think that you can provide our listeners with a perspective that a lot of them don't get. So I really appreciate your taking the time to join us today.
Welcome.
Well, the first thing I want to do, just to clear it up for people that might not know, where is the Mexican Wolf Blue Range Recovery Area?
So the official recovery area encompasses the Gila National Forest, the Apache Sitgraves National Forest also, and the White Mountain Apache Tribe is a cooperator in the recovery program, but their lands are not officially part of the recovery area, and neither are the San Carlos tribal lands. So that's something that is often misunderstood because both of the tribes do allow wolves on their land. The White Mountain allows wolves to reside there. The San Carlos allows wolves to move through but not establish a residence there.
So am I correct then that the recovery area spans both New Mexico and Arizona?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is the Wolf Range Rider Program?
The Range Rider Program is essentially having a person on the ground within the recovery area, working with the ranchers, livestock producers, the field team, and others, if need be, land management officers, agents and things. And they monitor both cattle and the wolves. And essentially the job is to prevent conflict from happening on the landscape.
Okay, so that is the intent of the program then. That's actually why it was started, to minimize conflict between livestock and wolves.
Yeah, to minimize conflict and then thus the resulting deaths a lot of times in either livestock or wolves because of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, how long has the Range Rider program been going on?
I know here in the Southwest there were range riders as early as 2007. It could have been before that, but that's when I'm aware of the first ones in Arizona. But up north, the program has been going on longer than that, and it's pretty much where the idea was established when you're looking specifically at wolf and cattle conflict. I mean, obviously, ranchers have had cowboys out on the landscape forever, so this is just a little bit modified from that idea and focusing on that conflict, reducing that conflict.
Okay, so who actually oversees the program in the recovery area, the Range Rider program?
Well, Kathy Taylor works for the U.S. Forest Service out of Arizona, and she is the interagency field team member, the IFT member, that specifically supervises that program on both the in New Mexico and Arizona. And the whole field team, which is a conglomerate of different agencies, is in general responsible for that program as it falls underneath their responsibilities.
Now, you mentioned that it is a conglomerate of various agencies. Can you tell us what those agencies are?
So there's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Arizona Game and Fish, the Wildlife Services, the Forest Service, White Mountain, White Mountain Apache Tribe, and those are the ones that I can say for sure are involved in that. New Mexico, the state of New Mexico pulled out of that cooperative agreement recently.
Oh, and I would just like to interject here and let our listeners know that Cynthia is not speaking for any agency today. Everything you hear her say on this show, she's speaking for herself.
Yeah, thanks.
So, you know, just to talk a little bit more about the program to give people an idea of what it's about, who funds the Range Rider program?
Funding comes from a lot of different places. Sometimes it's the states. Sometimes it's federal money. There's also nonprofits, such as the Mexican Wolf Fund out of the California Wolf Center, that fund Range Rider or proactive programs on the landscape.
Well, you know, before I go on and ask you some more questions about the program itself, I just wanted to backtrack a little bit. And you've spent many years dedicating yourself to educating people about the wilderness, taking people in the wilderness so they can experience what it is to be there. I know you have a real love for the Gila, the wild places, and also for wolves. And could you just share with us a bit of your background and let us know how you got to where you are today?
Well, I'll start off by telling you that, yes, my last name is Wolf. I didn't change my last name, but yes, I was raised by wolves. a little humorous start there. I grew up, spent most of my childhood in a rural conservative farming community in the Midwest. We moved to Montana when I was young and then returned to Indiana. But I have those roots in agriculture and being outside and hunting and fishing and all of that. And so I have to tell you that really I think that this type of work kind of chose me, because I just kept finding myself trying to pull groups together and pull directions together, and was able to walk that line in the middle. And yeah, I do have a love for wilderness and wildlife and working rural communities too. I think it all goes hand in hand if we really try to make it work out there.
Okay, Cynthia. Well, thanks for sharing with us some of your background. Okay, and I just want to jump right back in to talk about the Wolf Range Rider Program. And the next question I wanted to ask you is, grazing in the Gila is typically year-round. So is the Range Rider program seasonal in nature, or does it occur year-round as well?
I wouldn't say that it's necessarily seasonal in nature. Whenever there's a need and a willingness on the part of a livestock producer to have somebody out there doing the range riding, then the field team looks at that and they see if they have the funding to support the project, and they go from there. In general, this occurs when there's calves on the ground, because they're the most vulnerable component of all this when you look at cattle management. So then when you look at it that way, you would say that, well, in general, the Range Rider program then would be starting up pretty soon, the possibility of that, like within the next month, as cows are calving, and then go through spring and the summer months into the fall, probably around the 1st of November, when most producers ship out their calves.
Does a rancher have to request a range rider? I mean, is that how it comes about, and then it's set up?
It can happen that way. Sometimes, if the field team sees that there might be a good fit there with somebody, then they may approach the producer about having a range rider. Or, you know, it's just an offer. And the field team also, you know, is very involved in the livestock community, in letting people know what is out there and what's available to them. And they have meetings. Last year we had a range rider workshop where ranchers were invited to. So I think it works both ways, but certainly, obviously, the producer needs to be the one that gives the final approval for doing that, because without their support of being out there in their cattle, then it wouldn't be very successful.
So actually, it also sounds like the Range Rider program has a lot to do with building trust among all those that are participating, so it can be a more effective program.
Trust is an element, and I guess this is a sensitive thing for me, because I guess for me, when I'm out there, I'm thinking of, you know, doing my job, keeping conflict at a minimum, monitoring the livestock, monitoring the cattle. And if I'm doing my job, then trust, hopefully, is an outcome. But I think that building trust has kind of become this buzzword kind of thing, this buzz phrase. And I think that sometimes it kind of inhibits really what can go on more organically if people are just focused on reducing, you know, the conflict and doing their job well. You don't get into a marriage or some other kind of relationship and say, oh, we're going to build trust here. You have a common ground, a common place where you're overlapping, and then you start working together and you learn about each other. And trust is an outcome of that, hopefully, but you don't set out to quote-unquote build trust. So, like I said, I think that's just a personal thing of mine that I'm very sensitive to, because I think that it kind of interferes a lot of times with really getting the job done out there. And if you get the job done, people are going to trust you.
It makes perfectly good sense to me. So then what I really want to ask you next is, how effective do you think the program is in terms of protecting both wolves and livestock in terms of mitigating conflict?
I think that there's been a lot of success out there. A lot of that depends on operations. All operations are different. Times of the year are different. Wolf packs are different. So there's no one silver bullet solution as to what's going to work. And I think it really takes the collaborative efforts of the field team, the livestock producer, and the range rider to really, you know, make that work and to keep experimenting with that and find out what is going to work in this certain situation with these cattle and this pack of wolves.
Well, we're going to take a station break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Earth Matters, and our guest today is Cynthia Wolf, and Cynthia is a member of the Range Rider program in the Mexican Wolf Blue Range Recovery Area. And we were just talking about the effectiveness of this program in mitigating conflict. And to continue along that same line, I wanted to ask you, Cynthia, if or what your sense is in terms of how ranchers feel about the Range Rider program?
Well, I'm probably not exactly comfortable answering for ranchers, but what I will say is that I feel like that it's been a big benefit on the landscape to both livestock operations and the wolf program, and certainly there's many examples of where there's been known issues, either seasonally or over seasons with wolf packs, and those conflicts have been reduced, you know, by bringing in the Range Rider program or other proactive measures.
Given that there have been the successes that you're talking about, we don't seem to hear, and when I say we, I'm really referring to the public, we don't seem to hear much about the program and the successes that are occurring on the ground. I mean, is that simply because people aren't asking about it, that do the reporting? Is that why?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I think that that's really unfortunate. It's unfortunate because there's a lot of support out there to reduce conflicts, and there's a lot of support from some of the nonprofits that are supporting these programs, the proactive programs. And in my experience, it has been that it isn't one of those things that, I guess, you want to say is newsworthy, or if you're talking about success, people, you know, the media doesn't want to talk about the success. They want to talk about the shouting and screaming at meetings, or, you know, how polarized people are. And I get this a lot. You know, I'm in town and I'm grocery shopping and I run into somebody and they ask what I'm doing and I'm telling them and they say, oh, that must be really hard. And I will tell you that it hasn't been really hard. It's been really easy. And that doesn't mean that there's no difficulties. I'm not saying that. But people are welcoming out there. They're kind. They're generous. They're helpful. They're supportive. And I think that that is the message that we all need to bring to this, and that I hope that this program can bring to it, because I think it's only hurting ourselves and the wildlife and the ranchers, you know, to try to make it seem like there's a huge war going on out there. Certainly there's differences of opinion, there's no doubt about that, but people are cooperating, there's been a lot of success. And again, it's just really unfortunate that those things aren't talked more about than what people see as failures or the disagreements.
Well, you know, I think that's a good segue into my next question, because we do hear a lot about those enviros and those ranchers. So based on your firsthand experiences working with a wide cross-section of stakeholders, as you've just been talking about, do you think lumping folks all together like that reflects the on-the-ground situation?
Absolutely not. And, you know, just for me in my own life, I really don't like to lump people anyway, because we're all individuals and we act differently in different situations. And it does nothing really but give us false impressions of people. It's prejudice, you know, when we just put everybody together. And the other thing that I see that it does is, what does happen, is that groups or beings are then villainized. So if you're a quote-unquote enviro, you know, then you're villainizing people that are, you know, making their living producing livestock. And if you're producing livestock and you're villainizing wolves, then you're, you know, villainizing a really important part of an ecosystem and biodiversity that we all need. And so I think that a lot of that does come out of this either-or thinking. And, you know, it's us against them. And then there's a war, because then there's an enemy and there's a villain. And where there has been success is when people acknowledge that there's an issue, a problem, and they get together and figure out how to resolve that problem. And you never really know how that's going to work. You have to sit down at the table. And I think that that's another thing, is that a lot of times people can believe that they have the answer and that they just need to convince, quote unquote, the other guy, you know, of what the answer is. Resolution doesn't usually work that way. Resolution is everybody contributing. And, you know, we have producers out there that are, gosh, you know, third, fourth, fifth generation ranchers that have been on this land. And they've managed these herds, you know, their whole lives, and probably, you know, as they were growing up too. So we really need to acknowledge everyone's wisdom out there and not go in believing that we have the answer and that we just need to, you know, tell somebody else how to do it.
And so do you feel that the Wolf Range Rider program is part of the solution or a way to resolve certain differences?
I think that it is certainly for some people. It's a step in exploring, you know, what it can look like. And, you know, you got to think about this. I mean, it's risky to make changes. None of us like to make changes. I mean, we don't even like to change what we eat, right? I mean, I'm happy that, you know, I'm having digestive issues and I have to change what I eat, and I'm really mad about it.
Right.
I mean, you know, I don't want to quit eating bread and gluten and those things. And I think about, you know, something like that. And then I think about, you know, people that are on the landscape and, and have people come in and try to tell them, you know, how they should be doing things. So I do think that the Range Rider program and the proactive programs all combined together are really important, because we're all experimenting. None of us know the answers. And so I think that that is the most important thing that we can start doing, is just going into these issues not believing that we know the answer.
So when you're out there and you're doing your job, all right, what is your day like? Can you share that with people? What is your day like?
It's always so different. It really is. It depends on what's going on. It depends on, where the cattle are, where the cattle are going to go next. Depends on the wolves, what's going on with the wolves, especially, during different stages of their breeding cycle, if they've got puppies on the ground or if they're trying to den or whatever. So I'll just say that there's no average day, and that huge range of activities from, being horseback and being out riding through the cattle, looking to see if anything's stirred up, or if you got tight bags on cows, or things like that. A lot of activity out there where you can tell that the cattle are agitated. Some days it's really just going out, and if you don't hear, like let's say that you don't have a signal from the telemetry on the wolves.
So can I interrupt you right here and ask you, can you then explain to people how it is that you know wolves are present?
So are wolves present in the cattle? So you look at the behavior of the cattle, and you look at some of those things that we've already talked about. Behavior, is everybody kind of settled in and grazing or laying down and eating? Are they paired up? Are the calves with their mamas, or are they with the babysitters or whatever? And if everything seems pretty calm out there, then probably, there's not anything going on at the moment. There's track and sign. So you might see tracks, or you might see scat, or a lot of times howling. Because I was camped out there near the cattle,
So you do bed down near the livestock at night?
Yeah, usually I'm in earshot of either the cattle or wolves. It depends on what I'm trying to focus on. And again, that just is working with the rancher and the field team and trying to determine, do I want to stay in the cattle and help them be vigilant, or do I want to be on the edge of the cattle? And if the wolves come in, do I want to try to haze them and push them away?
So do you use radio telemetry equipment to track the movement of the lives of the wolves at all?
Yeah. So, yes.
Could you kind of describe for our listeners what that involves? Because some of them might not know.
Sure. So the field team at different times of the year and throughout the year have traps in the ground and live trap the wolves, and then they place collars on them, radio collars, and then if you're monitoring them, you have a receiver, and you can pick up that signal that's a specific frequency from the collar that's on the wolf, the individual wolf, and they're all different, and so you have the receiver and an antenna. And you swing that around a bunch, wave it over your head, and see if you can pick up a signal. And, sometimes the terrain is such that it isn't always easy to find them. But especially if you're hanging right next to the cattle and just trying to make sure that the wolves aren't in the cattle, you can usually determine that with the receiver, the radio telemetry gear. And so there's also, so we talked about different things. We talked about behavior of the cattle, and we talked about being able to track the wolves with track and sign and howling, which was really incredible this past season to, I got to hear puppies howl. And you can really determine a lot that way too. For example, with the Elkhorn pack, we really weren't sure if they had any puppies or not. And I got to hear one of the puppies trying to howl and voice his opinion.
Can you howl like a puppy for us? Is that possible?
I don't think I want to do it in this microphone. No offense, well, Kyle. But
I thought I would just ask. All right, I tried. But anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah. I couldn't resist.
there was a lot. You can really learn a lot that way too. Of you know, and detecting wolves rendezvousing. Like if you have collars on some and not on the others, you know, you can know that the collared animal is there, and then when another adult comes in, if you know they're paired up, you can determine that, well, that's, you know, the male coming in, because here's the female, and they howl at each other. And like I said, there was the puppy that we weren't getting any photographs of her. They also use the wildlife trail cameras, so we have some of those set up at places, so we use that to look for the wolves, the howling. And, so there's a lot of ways, you know, really, to monitor what's going on out there. And I think that that's one of the really, really great advantages to being camped out there. It's a great experience, you know, anyways. But I think that being out there on the landscape 24/7 and just, you know, if you're cooking supper, you know, you might hear a wolf howl, right? And it's a great way to be able to monitor all that.
And on that howling note, we're going to take a station break and we'll be right back. Well, welcome back to Earth Matters, and we're here with our guest, Cynthia Wolf, and we're talking about the Range Rider program in the Mexican Wolf Blue Range Recovery Area. And Cynthia, you were talking about how you know wolves are present in the area, you know, when you're watching a herd of cattle. And you mentioned that if they're around, sometimes you haze wolves. Can you explain to us what that means, what it is that you actually do when that occurs?
Hazing will occur sometimes if wolves come into the presence of cattle. And there are sometimes when the best management would be to move the cattle. But in general, in the Blue Range Recovery Area, what we're doing is hazing the wolves and actually trying to move them out of the area instead of moving the cattle. There are times where it may happen differently, like if you have if you have a wolf den in the middle of, you know, a pasture, and it would be in the best interest of everybody if the cattle are maybe just moved to a different pasture during the denning time. So there are some situations where you might move the cattle. But in general, what we're doing are hazing the wolves away. So there's several ways to do that. And mostly it's just ways to make things uncomfortable for the wolves, whether it's through noise or human activity and things like that. So you just want it to feel uncomfortable to them. And you want to switch it up all the time so that they don't get conditioned to something.
Okay, so they don't habituate.
Exactly. So, you know, and it can include, you know, going out there and banging pots and pans together, or using a four-wheeler, you know, in an area and just going back and forth and be really agitating. I know it's agitating to do that, so surely it has to be agitating to the wolves to experience.
It is. I've seen an African elephant run when they've done that too, so it does work.
Yeah.
Yes, I know.
And then there's other, some more aggressive but non-lethal measures still of cracker rounds, rubber bullets, and things like that, you know, that are shot into the air and make a lot of loud noises, and it's very unexpecting.
Well, what makes you, how do you decide what hazing method you use? I mean, is there a rule of thumb, or do you just try something?
I would say that you can just try something. And what I would also say that in my position, because I was getting direction from the field team and not a specific rancher, I worked with the field team on that who were also working with the rancher, just so that we were all on the same page about really, you know, what they wanted me to do and in general where we were wanting the wolves to move, which wasn't necessarily always where they did move. So you just kind of try whatever works and with whatever is within, you know, reach of you at the time. I mean, you're horseback, and that can create some commotion for the wolves too. If you go in, you know, in the middle of them, or if you're picking them up on the telemetry and you know, you want to push on them, it's like, it's great. I did that one time, I remember, with the Fox Mountain Pack, and I kind of felt sorry for the wolves because, you know, I could follow them and I was following them, and then they would like start to drift down the hill, and so I'd swing down and get around them to the east and push them back. I was trying to get them to go to the west.
Okay.
And then they would start like going more to the east, and then I would go back over that way and swing around, and it's like, you know, without the telemetry.
You were dancing with wolves.
I was. They might not have thought so, but
right.
I was. So it was great because of the telemetry. I was really able, and they were willing to move, right? And they didn't just squirt out of there. I was able to keep directing them, you know, in the direction that I wanted them to go, and was able to, you know, push them into an area where it was better for them to be.
So, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because that reminded me of a question that I wanted to ask you and I forgot to.
Okay.
Before we had our station break. Now I'm talking about how you actually feel now, okay? You just described how you were riding your horse and how you were coordinating your movements with wolves, trying to get them to go the Fox Mountain Pack. Can you describe to our listeners how it feels to be on horseback in wolf country when you are, in essence, interacting with wolves to try and mitigate conflict? I mean, can you just describe how that feels?
Well, I will tell you that, first of all, it feels like there's a lot of responsibility on my shoulders. There's a lot of people and a lot of effort out there, so I don't mean that I'm the only one out there, but, you know, I'm the one that's camped out there. I'm the one that's monitoring the wolves, trying to keep them out of the cattle, and it does feel like a really huge responsibility. And there's no doubt that, you know, I take it very personally. I mean, I certainly, you know, do not want to have any conflict on my watch, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so there's that piece of it that, you know, is kind of heavy. and then
understandably so.
Yeah. But then there's the other part of it that really is very grandiose, you know, and like I said, with a rural background, I mean, I'm in a place that I love. I'm in a, you know, in a wild place. I'm with my people, you know, with agricultural backgrounds. And I'm working to try to help reduce conflict, you know, between those groups of people. So it really is pretty magical to, you know, to tell you the truth. And like I said, also because you're just out there all the time and you're experiencing all these things and, you know, you get to know the place really well. And that is something that I think is a real benefit of the Range Rider program and having somebody camped out there, is because you are experiencing the same vulnerabilities as everybody else that's trying to fight to make a living out there. The livestock producers, the wildlife, including the wolves. You don't go home to an office every night. You got to haul your water. You know, it gets damn cold out there. You know, I mean, there were times where my dog's water was frozen solid in November. It was chilly out there camped out. And so I think that, you know, you get to intimately experience the vulnerability of the landscape. And, you know, when you're talking about trust and some things like that, I think that it helps build a credibility out there, you know, when people are willing to do that and when they're really willing to expose themselves to the same elements that everybody else is having to deal with out there. And it makes the job, I think, seem more real to people, if that makes sense.
No, I think it does make sense. And it also sounds, when you describe your experience being out there, that it really brings your senses alive.
Yeah.
And that's just how it comes across.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, you know, I love it out there. I mean, and it was a place, mostly I was north of Luna.
Okay.
And it was a place that I hadn't, you know, really spent a lot of time before. And I mean, it's just beautiful out there. And I mean, to be out there and every morning and every night see the sunset and see it rise in the morning, and you know, the same with the moon. And I did a lot of night work. You know, wolves tend to a lot of their predation, their hunting, right, does occur, you know, early morning and in the evening. And so that's a good time to be active and to kind of switch things up like that. So, I mean, there were a lot of nights where I was out riding. And yeah, it's just like I said.
So when it's not a moonlit night, you're using the stars, starlight.
Yeah, and plus my mare. I
mean, yeah, of course.
She knows where camp is. She may not know where all the fences are, but she knows where camp is. So yeah, I mean, there's, and you're just, like I said, you're just, you know, you're really exposed. But those are the kinds of places where I've felt like I've done my best work, you know, just whatever in my whole career is, you know, being out on the landscape, experiencing it, having the same vulnerabilities as the other people that I'm trying to work with. And, you know, and it's really where I want to be anyway. So it's perfect.
Well, I'm really glad that you want to be there. And I'm really glad that you're out there protecting wolves and livestock. And it comes across, certainly, that you've had a lot of experience working with ranchers in wolf country. So can you just talk to our listeners a bit about other non-lethal tools and methods that are available to minimize conflict?
Oh, okay, like proactive things?
Yes,
okay,
yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yes,
we talked about, yes, the non-lethal hazing things.
Right, right.
Right, okay. So, yeah, there's many things, and I think, you know, all the time we're discovering new tools or experimenting with new tools. There's obvious, some of the obvious ones, fences, permanent fences. We'll just start there. That's a, you know, a permanent structure where, let's say that a rancher on their private land has an area where they normally calve, and that wolves have, you know, commonly come in and been a threat there. So we might suggest putting up a fence, a permanent fence, 8 foot tall, just to contain the cattle in that area while they're calving. And so something that goes along with that is then to look at trying to not overgraze. Then you might also provide supplemental feed, you know, to that person, so that they can afford to keep them in behind these, you know, closed fences. And not available?
Well, are there funds that are used to pay for that supplemental feed?
Yeah, there sure are.
All right. And, yeah, and where do those funds come from?
The same places as before. You know, okay, either through the states or federal funding. I guess something to mention, too, is the federal interdiction program. And I'm not sure how that's exactly working yet. It's kind of in its baby stages of implementation. It's been on the table for a long time, but there is some money in there where people can, you know, ask for help in using some of these proactive measures, and also in compensation. They are giving some compensation also here in the Southwest. That's as far as I understand that interdiction program is only for the Southwest, the one that Tuggle introduced and supports. So there's a lot of different places, and then again with the nonprofits, the people that you know, are supporting this work on the ground. So there's fences, there's supplemental feeding, there's pasture rotations, like we talked about with the den sites. You know, like, okay, this is not a good place for your cattle to be, right, or your livestock. We had some sheep, a sheep permittee too in Arizona, but this isn't a good place for your livestock to be right now. And then, you know, everybody would work together. So meaning the livestock producer, the IFT, and then the land management agency would work together and see if there's another place that perhaps the herd could go for that period of time, where they're at the den site until the puppies start going to rendezvous sites. So there's that as an option. And of course, the range rider program, and you know, there's other things that are out there too. Shifts in management, in the herd management, different breeds of cattle, different times of calving, community calving.
So are they experimenting with different breeds of cattle out there on the Gila?
I do know that there was a rancher that threw in some horned, you know, some horned cattle with their herd. But I tell you, those, I think they're Corriente, those spotted calves don't bring very much money, and, you know, and neither do the horns. So there's consequences, or, you know, there's things to look at with every change that you make, because most of these places have really invested a lot of time in researching and knowing, you know, what works best for their production and for their operation. So,
well yeah. If I can ask you, I understand that in the Northern Rockies, there are some ranchers that have been using a breed of cattle that still have the instinct to herd, okay, when they're threatened. Do we have anything like that going on in the Gila at all, as far as you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know breeds of cattle. I know that what's happened with the livestock industry is that what we've done with everything, you know, with our horses and with our dogs and everything, is that we've bred things to get along with us.
Right.
you know,
right,
so, right. So, you know, and even within breeds, you know, if you got some hooky cow out there, you know, you might call her, you know, if she's gonna charge at you every time that you go out there. There are probably some of those things right now that people are starting to rethink, you know, because of that. Because what we do want are aggressive cattle, that will defend their babies and you know, defend themselves against predators. So I think there's some of that that's being rethought. To my knowledge, I'm not aware of any operation that has decided to completely switch to a different breed. But again, there's different things. Like, you can run, cow pairs with yearlings, and that helps to settle down, you know, the whole herd. The mama cows know the place. They know where all the water is. They're not so flighty. Yearlings are, in general, really flighty. So there's just so many different things like that. And again, I think it just looking at the operation and working with the wisdom of the livestock producer, and, you know, trying to figure out what might be a shift or something, you know, to really focus on in changes there, or more of what they're already doing.
Well, I know that we're going to have to take a break in just 1 minute, but I would like to ask one quick question if I can. You mentioned calf-cow pairs and yearlings, and you were talking about grouping them together, you know, different strategies. Do cow-calf pairs and yearlings respond differently to wolves?
Yeah, they just, I mean, in general, they respond differently to threat.
Okay, uh-huh.
Yeah, so like I said, in general, yearlings are much more flighty than cows. And so, but a lot of times, what has happened is that you might have someone who is leasing some land, and this is probably more on private land, but it happens where, you know, you've got some land, for whatever reason, you don't have the cattle to fill it, so you might lease that to somebody. And a lot of times, it's with yearlings because, you know, they come in, they graze for the summer season, and then they go off to the feedlot. So with the, you know, with the cows, with the cow-calf operation, you have the cows year-round. So a lot of times, it's the yearlings that can come in on those leases, on those short-term leases, and then everybody makes a buck, and the cattle go down the road. So does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So they do act differently. They definitely, you know, I mean, they're young. I mean, they're teenagers. You know, they're teenagers. So
right.
They don't have that wisdom. They don't have knowledge of the land and all those things. So they do act differently.
Well, you're listening to Earth Matters, and we better take a station break. Well, welcome back to Earth Matters, and this is Kim McCrary, and our guest today here is Cynthia Wolf, and we're talking about the Range Rider Program. And Cynthia, I wanted to ask you, when it comes to the Range Rider Program and your being out there with wolves, how does what you do tie into respect and good stewardship of the land?
Well, I think it stems from the fact that you have a lot of people working together. You have a livestock producer that is more than likely a permittee with a land management agency. You have the agencies themselves that are cooperating and collaborating with the program. The field team people, the agencies managing the wolves. And so everyone is kind of coming in from their own little world, to mix up and say, how can we do this better? How can we do it so that the land is better? How can we do it so that you can operate with a profit and so that we can still have diversity on the landscape and our wildlife? So I think that it fits with that really well in looking at that.
So it kind of sounds like you're saying that ranchers, conservationists, all the folks, agency people involved, they share common values and they want to come together and try and make something work on the ground for wolves and the people that ranch in that area.
Well, I think that I think there's a lot of common ground, and I think that it helps to highlight that. And again, I think that the more that the agency people, whether it be wildlife or land management, are, out there and working with people, even if it's like through an extension through the Range Rider program, that we all get to see those common places a lot more. And again, instead of, and this is the worst case scenario, but, being at meetings and just hearing people shouting at each other and, for a lot of people, that's the only experience that they, or the only observation that they ever get of that interaction, between these different thought groups. I think it's really unfortunate because there really is a lot of overlap out there.
I've heard folks say that they're afraid of being in the wilderness. And I've also heard folks say that they're afraid of wolves. How would you respond? How do you respond to that?
Speaking of respect, I would say respectfully. Certainly, I'm not the person to tell somebody else what they should or should not be afraid of. Now, if it's introduced as a conversation, for example, I have children, and this is what I've heard, and what do you think about that? Well, then I feel like that there's some space for input there. But if I have somebody telling me, that they need a shelter built at the bus stop because they're, afraid that the wolves might attack their children while they're waiting for the bus, I need to honor that. I mean, it's a fear that they have. And again, and that's just in my general life. I'm not going to dismiss somebody else's fear. and I also don't think that it does very much good. I hear this happen a lot where people try to compare, the possibility of a wolf conflict or, with people. To getting struck by lightning or, something like that. And I guess the thing for me is, I used to live in Florida. I went to school there for a couple of years. And you could throw me overboard out in the middle where I couldn't have seen any land. And I was not afraid of anything. I wasn't afraid of sharks. I swam out to this little island during low tide. I did different things. And if I moved to Florida right now, you could not get me in the water. And, you can tell me all the statistics about, how shark attacks are very minimal and, you have more of a chance of whatever than a shark attack. And I'm probably not going to swim out to the Egmont Key Island anymore. So I think as part of respect and honoring other people and their perceptions, which are their reality, we just have to go with that and address it from that spot instead of trying to dismiss their fears.
So then I'll ask you about fear this way. Do you fear wolves?
I respect wolves. And
what I will say is that in Wolf Country, my dog is never just out on her own. I wouldn't leave her outside my home if I, you know, lived in, you know, in the midst of all of it. And it's not just for wolves, it's for, you know, for other predators too. I mean, even just coyotes. I have a great respect. I don't really feel like a healthy wolf is going to attack me under normal circumstances. So I guess that's kind of how I look at it. But I think that just having awareness out there, that's the main thing that I try to carry with me, is an awareness of what's going on, and, you know, to read whatever it is out there. If I'm, you know, in the cattle, or if I'm out riding around at night, or any of those things, I just try to have an awareness and, you know, not make myself unnecessarily vulnerable.
So, from your unique vantage point, what can people do to help make wolf recovery successful in the Gila?
Look in the mirror. I say that because, again, from my own perspective, you ask from my own perspective. From my own perspective, we are spending way too much energy trying to make other people wrong, pointing the finger. And I think that we need to, and I certainly try to do this for my own self, is that we need to look in the mirror and we need to be asking ourselves, what can we do differently? Can we ride our bike to the post office and down to the store so that we're not using fossil fuels, and so that they're not having to drill in places where there's wolves or other wildlife or whatever? I just think I always say look in the mirror and not judge other people. Not judge the choices that they're making. If you look at my life, I drive a big Dodge diesel 3/4-ton truck, pull an 18-foot horse trailer. I got 5 head of stock. I could probably look like an environmentalist nightmare if you really wanted to, take a scorecard to that. But my mules have backed in wolves into the Gila, been on Gila trout projects, you know, just lots of other things. And so it's like, we just have to use the tools that we have in our lives, and I think what we're good at, to do what we can and not judge other people for what we feel like they should be doing.
And on that note, I would like to thank you, Cynthia, for joining us here today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thanks. Thanks for having me. It was fun. And I hope to talk to you again soon.
All right. And thank you, listeners, for listening to Earth Matters, a show about earthly matters that impact us all.